This episode is brought to you by Seems Easy Record Sleeve Repair Strips. If you collect used records, you need some Seems Easy strips handy for record sleeve repair. They're super easy to use and repair those seam splits to make them like new.
Ask your record store for Seems Easy or go to SeemsEasy.com.
Seems Easy with two Z's. SeemsEasy.com. And now, on with the show. Well, hey, everyone, it's Nate. Welcome to episode 367 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And today we've got an amazing conversation with world-renowned record collector, dealer, and all-around nice guy, Mr. John Tefteller. Now, those of you familiar with John will know that this man hunts records down like a detective. I mean, he scours the dark closets and under the beds of America to find the rarest of rare blue 78s and memorabilia. John has paid thousands of dollars for rare records and then pays even more to have them restored for distribution as part of his annual Blues Images calendar. Now, unfortunately, that Blues Images calendar will be coming to an end. 2023 will be the last issue of this calendar, and John will explain all about his decisions today, plus why he's pulling out the stops on this one. Lots more music, lots more rare blues recordings he's been saving just for the right time to share, and here it is. Now, if you like the blues, or are a music nerd, or even have someone on your Christmas list who is, I highly recommend the Blues Images calendar. You can pick one or several up from bluesimages.com. They're only $29. The calendars come with some beautiful artwork, lots of fantastic blues facts and stories from notable blues records and labels, and it has a CD that comes along with it, this year with 25 super rare blues tracks that you will not hear anywhere else. Grab one or even several of these Blues Images calendars now. Hand them out to your friends for the holidays. Head on over to bluesimages.com. Now, the interview you're hearing now is only about half the conversation I had with John. The other half is available only to show patrons at patreon.com/vinylguide. And not only is there more talk of blues records, but there's also a huge section on John's Marx Brothers collection. Back in the day, John used to work for Groucho in his final years, and he's amassed quite a collection of Marx Brothers recordings and material. And personally, I absolutely adore the Marx Brothers. So if you do too, and or want to help support the Vinyl Guide podcast, please go to patreon.com/vinylguide. Pick a monthly support tier that works for you and enjoy the super extended interview with John Tefteller, plus heaps of other benefits up at patreon.com/vinylguide. Extended episodes, high-resolution audio files, commercial-free versions of all interviews, and heaps more. And again, that's only for show patrons at patreon.com/vinylguide. Head up there now, and thanks in advance for your support. And finally, John has been on the Vinyl Guide before. Four other times, episodes 23, 93, 195, and 251. Go check out his other fascinating tales and commentary from those episodes. And if you like that kind of thing, we've also had Charlie Musselwhite on the show, episode 59, and jazz great Lou Donaldson, episode 231, plus hundreds more. All episodes are available to enjoy anytime on your podcast app. Simply subscribe or follow the Vinyl Guide podcast. Scroll, download, listen, and enjoy. And with that, let's pick up the phone and talk to the owner of the world's rarest records, Mr. John Tefteller.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, back on the Vinyl Guide for I think his fourth appearance, maybe fifth, I've lost count. The owner of some of the world's rarest records, Mr. John Tefteller. How are you today, John?
Well, hello, Nate, and thank you for having me on again. Yeah, I've been on a few times, and it's always fun to do this, so whatever you want to do today, I'm ready to do.
Well, I always collect questions throughout the year because I always know we have a conversation about once a year. And throughout the year, I get all these different kind of factoids pop in my head. So I have a bunch to roll through. But I think first and foremost, The 2023 Blues Images calendar, I learned that this is going to be the last blues calendar of record. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. There's just too many factors that are contributing to me having to give it up. declining sales with too many younger people and a lot of older people now relying on their phones for calendars and not a wall calendar. So we're just not selling as many each year. It's less and less. The costs are going up and up and up, and it's just to the point where it doesn't make sense to continue on as much as I would like to. It doesn't make sense to do it.
That must have been a very difficult decision for you, because I know how passionate you are about the music and about distributing in it. And this has probably been coming for some time. It's not a gradual decrease in profits.
No, and I've kind of dropped a lot of not-so-subtle hints over the last 3 or 4 years that if things didn't improve sales-wise, that we were going to have to call it a day. And it's just gotten to the point where we're barely breaking even, and with all the excess costs coming in for this year and for next year, it just doesn't make economic sense to do it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, I know it's in your nature to share and put this music out there. Have you decided on a way to distribute your blues music in the future?
Well, I certainly don't want to give up sharing from my collection and sharing things that pop up that are unique and wonderful in the world of blues. I don't want to stop that, but I have to find a way to do it that actually doesn't just break even or lose money. It actually makes some money, because otherwise I could spend my time hunting records and selling records and doing other things and not do this. So what I think I'm going to do, and it's going to be a while because I'm taking a little bit of time off to complete another project that I've been working on off and on for the last 10 years, but we can talk about that later. It's a Marx Brothers related product. But until I finish that, I'm going to take some time off. And then if there is still any kind of market for CDs, I will issue a couple as an experiment and see how they go. And if they go and there's enough sales to justify all the costs and audio restoration, et cetera, then I'll keep on releasing things that way. If they don't result in enough sales, then I probably will have to hang it up, because I'm just not a fan of streaming and downloading and all the stuff that people tend to do these days with music, because it just tends to get all dumbed down in the process and not sound like anything.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, look, I'm keen to get into talking about this calendar. Just a real quick recap. What has the 78 record collecting environment been like throughout COVID?
You mean as far as finding things or selling things or what? I come at it from both ways. I'm a collector of pre-war blues, and I'm also a dealer in just about everything else record-wise from the 20s up to the 70s.
Mm-hmm. For example, have more super rarities popped up? More so in the last 12, 24 months, people have had more time to...
Not necessarily, no, although we have some really great ones on the new calendar. I wanted to go out with a bang, and so I pulled some stuff out of my archives, and some things were found in the last year or so since the last one, and I loaded it up with 25 tracks this time. That's the most we've ever had. We had 23 before, but I couldn't do it in 23. I had to go to 25, so we squeezed all 25 tracks onto the CD, and that's what people will get in the new one, is a full 25-track CD.
Hmm. Did anything pop up on your super wish list in the last 12, 24 months?
No. No, some nice things popped up, and we can talk about those as we talk about the tracks on the calendar and the new CD. But none of the big records, the really super desirable ones that the whole world is basically looking for, like the two lost Willie Brown 78s, and there's, I think, a lost...
J.D. Short, I think.
J.D. Short and William Harris. I mean, there's some really what... have to be really fabulous 78s that are missing that just may or may not ever show up. I don't know. I've been looking and looking and looking, and so has a whole bunch of other people, but they're well hidden if they still exist.
All right, so let's get into the 2023 calendar. Tell me some of the stories of the materials here, especially, I guess, to start with the cover picture, apparently from an unexpected Henry Thomas film clip?
Yes, there's a... Well, previous to this, and what you see on the cover of the new calendar is an ad, an original ad for his song Run Molly Run, and into that ad we have dropped a photograph of Mr. Thomas with his guitar and his little panpipe machine where he's blowing into it. Now, previous to this photograph, which is taken from a film, and I'll describe that in a minute, but prior to this photograph, the only photograph around of Henry Thomas, there's two versions of it. There's one small, tiny little grainy headshot that appeared on a Vocalion flyer, and that was around for many, many years, and people saw it, but it's so grainy and so washed out, it's very difficult to make out any features. You can just tell he looks like he's kind of an older guy. Then about a couple, 3 years ago, I found a different Vocalion flyer that had the same photo, but enlarged a little bit where you could see his panpipe and a little bit of the guitar. But again, very grainy and very, very difficult to make out the features. So most of these blues guys, when they recorded back in the 20s and 30s, not only did they make records, but they were required as part of their contract to sit for a photographer for at least one photo session, at which they could pick one or two photos from that session that would be used in publicity purposes, because they wanted to make sure that when they made the records, if they released them and the records became successful, they wanted to make sure they had a photograph of the singer, because a lot of those blues singers tended to disappear. They would make records and just kind of vanish, and then they had to be tracked down again if the record became successful. They had to be tracked down to bring them back in the studio to do more. So the studios and the record companies would insist on taking a portrait. So there's a lot more portraits of blues singers taken than we have ever, ever seen. Most of them have been long ago discarded, and every once in a while a new one pops up, but nowhere near do we have the number of photographs of singers that were actually taken. The photograph that we use on the front cover of the new calendar was taken from a 16 millimeter film. And it's not totally clear because we had to kind of pause the film and select a frame and pull it out and feed it into a computer and all that. So it's as good as we could get off that 16 millimeter film. But what happened was, within the last year or so, it was discovered that in 1928, a German camera crew came to Chicago to shoot a kind of a travel log film to encourage people from Germany to come visit Chicago. And when they did this film in 1928, they went around Chicago and they filmed various things to make a little travel log out of it. One of the places apparently that they went was the Maxwell Street Market in Chicago, which is a famous place where a lot of blues singers hung out and played. Everybody from who was anybody in the Chicago area all the way up through the 70s and into the early 80s till they finally closed the market down. They all played on Maxwell Street because they had a captive audience there. They got good tips and they could have a really fun atmosphere to play. So apparently, Henry Thomas was performing that day when this German film crew came through, and they shot 11 seconds of him sitting on the back of a pickup truck playing one of his songs. Now, it's 11 seconds. That's all we get, because they didn't know Henry Thomas would be important 80 years later. I don't know if they knew Henry Thomas was important in 1928, but they shot 11 seconds of Henry Thomas for this film, and that's where this still photograph was taken from.
Oh, and how did you come across this film clip and put it together that it was Henry Thomas?
Well, I didn't find it originally. Someone found it by looking at the film, and it was posted on one of the Facebook blues forums. They even did a screenshot as well and posted it up there and said, "Hey, gang, doesn't this look like Henry Thomas?" And, of course, people looked at it and immediately said, "It sure does." And, of course, we're now 100% sure it's him. But that's what happened. And then as a result of seeing that, I made some inquiries and I found out who the film company was now that held the rights to the film. And I sent them an official request to be able to use that picture on the front cover of the current new calendar for 2023, and they agreed to it, and so there it is.
Wow. That's amazing. Now, were there any other artists that were highlighted in that clip? It was of that?
No.
No?
Okay. Nope. Just 11 seconds of Henry Thomas. Now, when you see the clip, and I think it's on YouTube, I think you can find it on YouTube, when you see the actual clip, you can see that he's sitting on the back of a pickup truck, and you can see there's some background and somebody else off to the side. We removed all that and just put his image in the front, on the front cover.
Wow, what a fascinating story. See, things just keep popping up from unexpected sources.
Yeah, completely unexpected. No one would have ever thought that someone would have shot film of Henry Thomas in 1928. That just seems like an amazing thing.
And talk to me about his contribution to the 2023 calendar, his song.
Well, Run Molly Run is one of many songs that he recorded. His most famous song these days, well, it would be two that kind of tie in famousness. Bulldoze Blues, which was completely copied almost note for note by the rock band Canned Heat and released as Going Up the Country in 1968. If you're familiar with that song by Canned Heat, that's Bulldoze Blues by Henry Thomas. And the other one that keeps getting played all over the place these days is his fishing song, Fishing Blues, which appears on all kinds of sports channels whenever they do fishing stories or stories about fishing tournaments or whatever. Yeah. That song appears in the background, and it's been in some movies and all the rest of it. So those are the two. But Run Molly Run just had an interesting ad, and I thought it would look good on the front cover, and it does. So.
Yeah. All right. Well, all the discoveries aren't just vinyl or shellac. It's also imagery and now video.
Well, if we can, I think video is going to be near impossible. This is, of course, now the earliest known video or film of any blues singer at all, and there's very, very few others even from the later period. You don't start seeing video or film of blues singers until the 40s.
Yeah.
Anything in the 20s and 30s is virtually unheard of.
Now, you shared a little bit about the process that the record companies would have the blues artists sit in for a picture. The very famous image of Charlie Patton that you rediscovered,
yes.
Was that one of the pictures that they had to chase down? Do you know the history of when and how that picture was taken?
Yes, it was taken as his official portrait for Paramount, taken at his first session, when he first came into Grafton to record. They shot that photograph at a photography studio that's literally a block and a half from what was the Paramount recording studios in Grafton, Wisconsin.
So that was that image that we have of Charlie Patton was towards the beginning of his recorded career.
Yes,
is that correct? Okay.
Yes, yeah, it's done for the first session. Now, the unusual thing is, I'm convinced, although I have yet to find it, that when he switched from Paramount to Vocalion, that they also took a fresh portrait of him for Vocalion, but it's never showed up.
Got it. Okay. Do we know much about that transition of Paramount to Vocalion? Like his reasons? Was there money involved? That sort of thing?
I don't. I think it probably has been written about somewhere a little bit, but there is so little solid information that you can get anywhere on exactly how all these things went down. We know when his last recording sessions for Paramount were, and we know when his first session for Vocalion was, but that's about all we know. I don't think we know why or what happened. He probably got dropped by Paramount due to lack of sales, and somebody at Vocalion said, well, let's try him over here, and so they picked him up and started recording him for Vocalion. That's my best guess as to what happened, but I think that's about all we're ever going to have is a guess.
Now, you've got a Charlie Patton contribution to the calendar, Poor Me, which I believe was recorded just weeks before he died. Is that right?
Yes, and I decided to use that particular one because it's kind of a downer of a track, but it was taken from a brand new copy of the 78, and you almost, it's practically impossible to find a brand new Charlie Patton 78. Most of them look like 10 trucks that have run over them, but I was able to locate a brand new copy of Poor Me, and so new, in fact, that it had never, as far as I can tell, it never had a steel needle on it. And so it's just crisp and clear and vibrant, and you can hear every nuance of his playing and every nuance of his singing, and you can actually understand the words because it's not distorted and full of noise like a lot of his things are.
Mm. And where would you find a record like that? Is that just a record store B stock or something?
Yeah, once in a while, not much anymore, but once in a while, some usually very old person who had a father or a grandfather or a grandmother who worked in the music business and just took home some random boxes of 78s and never played them. Once in a while, you'll find something like this in one of those.
And Charlie Patton, when he was recording Poor Me, anything known about his state at the time?
His health was terrible. And he had had his throat slashed. Ugh. And so his normal energy level was kind of down. He doesn't have the same energy on the Vocalion recordings that he does on the Paramounts. And his ability to sing and deliver is also affected by the throat slashing. So, yeah, he does sound slightly different, but it's the same Charlie Patton. You can certainly tell it's him. He just sounds much more plaintiful and sorrowful and much more bluesy on these Vocalions than he did on the Paramounts.
Now, I don't know too much about the life of Charlie Patton, but this throat slashing, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask about that.
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay. Grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up.
Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside,
so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new.
Turn a $5 used record into a $50 functioning collectible.
Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That's Seems Easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. Now, I don't know too much about the life of Charlie Patton, but this throat slashing, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask about that.
Well, I don't know a whole lot about it, except he was kind of a wild character. And the story is that he got into a brawl with somebody, either over women or over whiskey or over something, and they slashed his throat, and he nearly died. But somehow they got him to the hospital in time, and he got sewn up, and he made it. But it was a close call from the way we understand it.
Wow. All right. So the song Poor Me is on the calendar, on the CD. And probably the best copy that anyone's ever going to hear in their lifetime they can get.
You're never going to hear Charlie Patton sound better than this. We might be able to make him sound on some of the other ones equal to this, but I don't think you're ever going to get better.
Did Charlie Patton see any success, any accolades for his music while he was alive?
Well, he saw enough accolades that he had several recording sessions for Paramount and at least one long recording session for Vocalion. As far as accolades, I guess back then it was enough of an accolade as far as it would go to be asked to go to New York to record for Vocalion. He had to leave the Mississippi Delta and go to New York to make those Vocalion recordings. I'm sure he got a trip out of it and probably some sightseeing and all that. But I don't know about accolades. These guys were very poor rural musicians playing on plantations and playing in juke joints and CD bars and whatever. I don't know how many accolades were ever thrown at them until much, much later.
Yeah, maybe the word accolades is the wrong one. Maybe recognition of his talent.
Well, I don't even know recognition because he was known in Mississippi. He had a pretty good reputation in Mississippi. He could be counted on to get people up and dancing. And he was known as kind of like a clown because he would do a lot of unique things like play guitar behind his head and all kinds of crazy stuff. But he also doubled as a preacher. So if you wanted to be married by Charlie Patton, I guess you could do that too.
Well, that'd be a fun thing to do if you had a time machine.
Yeah.
All right.
And that's something that I found very interesting is when they started talking about him living at Dockery and that they were having weddings at Dockery. Dockery was a big plantation in Mississippi. And they actually held weddings there and all the rest of it. And I've had it in the back of my mind forever that, well, you have weddings at Dockery. You have Charlie Patton as the guitar player for the wedding. Surely people were taking wedding photos at these events, and somebody somewhere must have captured Charlie sitting on the side or sitting on a bench or whatever playing guitar for the wedding, and yet none of these photographs have ever shown up, so I don't know if everything's just been destroyed over the years or what, but they've never come out.
Wow. You really think like a detective.
Well, you have to, because that's the only way to find these things. And even then, yeah, I can think like a detective all I want, but if everything's been thrown out and destroyed, it's of no use.
Well, let's talk about some of the other stuff on the calendar here. Where do we want to go to? Bessie Smith?
Whatever you want to discuss. I don't have a whole lot of knowledge of Bessie Smith. I think this particular song is pretty interesting. It's got some interesting sound effects in it. It's called Shipwreck Blues, and they do some interesting sound effects while she sings.
Is this a rare one? Is this one that is difficult?
It's from her last session for Columbia. There was one more that they did for the OK label, and then she died after that. So it's among the last songs that she recorded, and it's pretty interesting.
So you got quite the advertisement for the month of March for Shipwreck Blues on the calendar.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about John T. Smith's Old Rounders Blues. This sounds like it was a bit of an interesting find, yeah?
Well, he was known on the labels as Funny Paper Smith. His actual name was J.T. Smith or John T. Smith. This is from his first session. He had a number of records that were released. He was fairly popular for a short period of time. This particular one from the first session was never released, and the title was known because I guess it appears on the Vocalion logbooks, but there was no recording of it known. And about 6 or 8 months ago, a guy was basically scrounging records in Virginia, and he came across a one-sided test pressing on shellac with this title written on it, Old Rounders Blues and Funny Paper Smith, or whatever the name they put on the scratched into the shellac. And he called me, said he found this. I looked it up. I couldn't find that it had been released anywhere, although it was scheduled for release, and they did even assign a record number to it, but no copy has ever been found, so we just assume it wasn't released. But there it was, a one-sided test, and it's pretty darn interesting. It's a version of the Blind Lemon Jefferson song, Old Rounders Blues. He kind of updates it and changes it around, but it's the same song.
Okay. What was the condition of the copy that was found?
all right. It wasn't great, but we sure made it sound great.
Now, there's a whole process you have to go through on a lot of these records to get them up to acceptable listening or putting on the CD, yeah?
Well, a lot of people who are doing this kind of thing, and there's not that many anymore, but when this was a popular thing to do some years ago, they were calling it remastering, and I never really liked that word because I don't really want to remaster something. I would like to restore it to the way it was supposed to be. Remastering sounds like you've actually just sort of monkeyed around with the tape or the recording, and we don't do that. We go through and we actually take all the defects out of the records, one defect at a time. So that's a process that nobody else uses. I've offered it to other people, but it's a very expensive process, and nobody except me is willing to go through the expense to do it. But the end result is basically the gold standard of audio restoration for vintage blues. They just sound so good when they're finished. And it can take anywhere from 3 hours to 60 hours to do one three-minute song, depending on how much damage is on the original record. Because every single play that a record received from a diamond, from a steel needle on a wind-up phonograph, every single play was a different set of problems added to that record. More hiss, more clicks, more pops, more noise, more everything. And to find records from 80 years ago that have never had one of those needles touch them is near impossible. And so you have to take what you get, find the cleanest copy you can find, and start restoring from there. And it's a long, tedious process.
So, for example, this Charlie Patton Poor Me, you found this immaculate version of it by some miracle.
Right.
How do you play it? Like, what is the phonograph? What is the needle? What is the process of being able to then capture it?
Oh, well, how much into the weeds do you want to go here? I don't want to bore your listeners, but I can try to boil it down to a fairly quick pause.
I would imagine, you know, this record is something that you would only want to play once, you know, minimal time. So you have one or two shots to be able to grab this audio. How do you go about it?
Well, no, not necessarily. I mean, look, if you play a 78, whether it's used or brand new, if you play it on good quality equipment with the right needles and don't use those wind-ups and all that stuff, you can play them many, many times before you do any kind of damage to the record. The damage comes in playing them on that old equipment. Now, what we have is we have a brilliant studio engineer in Burbank, California, named Nick Berg. He runs a company called Endpoint Audio in Burbank, and he has the original lathes from the late 20s and early 30s that these records were first recorded on. He has the original equipment. And if you play them, these are not wind-up machines with steel needles. These are actual cutting lathes from the 1920s and 30s. And if you take an original 78 and play it back through the original equipment that it was meant to be played on, that it was cut on, you immediately lift all of the life and music out of the grooves in the best possible way. So Nick will make a transfer using this original equipment, and again, it's not a wind-up with a steel needle. It doesn't hurt him. It actually is the way they were supposed to be played in the studios back then. You play it with the original equipment, and you get as much of the original music and voice and everything out of those grooves as you possibly can. Along with that comes whatever noise and defects are there, but you get everything. You get a transfer that has everything in it. And then we give it to an engineer who will sit there and groove by groove, turn by turn, take the defects out one at a time. Most people that do this kind of thing use various computer programs or things that they can use where they can just lop off certain parts of the sound. So they lop off the high end, they lop off the low end, and you're left with kind of a muddy mid-range. Well, we don't do that at all. We leave the high end, we leave the bottom, and we leave the mid-range, and all we do is remove one at a time the original, the defects that were not on the original record.
Right. Okay. Now, Nick Berg, this lathe, this is the one that was in the documentary series?
Yes, American Epic. You can see it demonstrated there where he's actually cutting modern-day artists using that equipment.
All right, so let's talk about, let's go back to the calendar here, Blind Lemon Jefferson. What's the background on the Blind Lemon Jefferson track?
Well, I don't have any background on it. It's just another Blind Lemon Jefferson track, and he made a lot of records. Most of them are pretty darn interesting. Some of them tend to get a little repetitive. This one, Balky Mule Blues, is nice and crisp and clear. And just like Charlie Patton, for decades, the reissues of Blind Lemon Jefferson stuff haven't sounded that good. They've been muddy and distorted and very difficult to decipher what he was doing. But when we have nice, clean copies of the records and we use our restoration process, all of a sudden you can hear his tones, his intonations in his speech, and you can understand what he's saying. So it's why we do these.
And we go from Blind Lemon Jefferson to Blind Blake, Worried Blues.
Blind Lemon and Blind Blake were the two biggest selling artists that Paramount had, and they did a lot of ads for those guys, and so that's why we have a lot of ads to pick from, and that's why they wind up on all the calendars that they've wound up on in the past.
Now, you mentioned earlier the Old Rounders Blues was from a test pressing.
Yes.
The test pressings and those sort of shellacs that were never meant for distribution, how often do you run across something like that? They must be exceedingly rare.
Well, yes, they are. The one that we have here, the Old Rounders Blues by Funny Paper Smith, it's the only one known to exist. So usually when you find a test pressing, if you're lucky, it will be an alternate take of what was issued, or it will be a completely unissued song. Sometimes you'll find a test pressing that's exactly the same as the copies that were issued to the public, and the only difference would be they're usually just a little bit better quality. They used a little bit better shellac for the tests than they did for the regular ones that they sold to the public. So it's always good to find a test pressing. They always have some advantage to them, but when they're alternate takes or completely unreleased songs, it's even better. But they are very, very hard to find. Most of that stuff was scrapped shortly after it was used or not used, and that would have been 80 years ago, and you just don't see them, except every once in a while one will pop up somewhere.
Would those have been made typically from the recording studio or from the company that was actually manufacturing the shellac records?
Well, that's kind of the same thing in most cases. They had recording studios, and the record companies usually had recording studios within the building where the record company was located. Sometimes they would do field recordings where they would take equipment out into the field, so to speak, and like Victor would go to Memphis and record locally in Memphis or Chicago or wherever. But if they were recorded at the main company, which a lot of stuff was, they had the recording equipment right there on the premises.
In the calendar, you go into detail on why people need to give Papa Charlie Jackson's Lexington, Kentucky Blues a bit of a go. Why is that?
Well, it's not just that particular track. For years, Papa Charlie Jackson was kind of dismissed by the blues collecting community because most of the records that were released on him, he's playing a banjo, not a guitar. And so people just dismissed it like, well, he's like a kind of a folk singer with a banjo, and they're more like country records. They're not really blues. But if you start listening to Papa Charlie Jackson, you realize that, one, he played a really great banjo. He was really good. And two, he wrote pretty darn clever and insightful lyrics. And so you put those two things together, and his records are quite interesting. And so for the last 20 years of the blues calendar, we featured a lot of Papa Charlie Jackson records for that reason, and also because he was a fairly good seller for Paramount, and they did create a number of ads that we could use to promote within the calendar. So it's a dual purpose, but I just like to pick out people that really haven't been given their due as much as I think they should, and kind of focus on them on a regular basis. And that's what we've been doing with Papa Charlie Jackson. And actually, when I go to make some CDs after a bit of a rest here, Papa Charlie Jackson is one of the ones I'm considering doing, like a little box set on the best of Papa Charlie Jackson, or maybe the complete Papa Charlie Jackson or something like that, and get him his due in his own individual CD set.
Mm. And how many of Papa Charlie Jackson's songs exist as far as you're aware?
Oh, there's a lot. I'd have to count them, but I'd say 40 or 50 just
wow.
offhand.
Okay.
There's a lot. He made a lot of records.
And speaking of making a lot of records, Ma Rainey.
Ma Rainey sure made a lot of records. Yes, she did. And again, we use her because we try to get some women singers in there, so it's not all men. And we also want to use somebody that we have some really nice-looking advertisements for. And because she was Paramount's biggest-selling female artist, they did a lot of ads for her, so we have a lot to choose from, and that's how she winds up on the calendars.
Mm. So an artist like Ma Rainey, you know, we talked about alternate takes and things like that. Are there a lot of alternate takes or outtakes?
There are some, yes. I can't say when this is going to come out because there's been some delays, but the people that own the rights to Paramount now, who we license these things from, they have semi-completed a box set on Ma Rainey that's supposed to be released sometime in the next few months. Now, the last I heard, there's some delays with the booklet that's coming with it and getting it written and getting it edited, but all the sound transfers have been done, and it should be an interesting project because I think they've gone through and found every single existing Ma Rainey track, including some alternate takes and a couple unissued ones, and I gave them some stuff that I had. So it should be the most complete Ma Rainey thing ever, and we'll just have to wait until it's available.
Wow. Who's putting that out again? Sorry?
It's coming out from Black Swan Records in New Orleans, which is the current owner of the Paramount label. They don't own the Paramount name, but they own the songs and the label, and they use Black Swan because that was also a Paramount subsidiary label.
Got it. Okay. So if you want to get anything Paramount, with the exception of the label, that's who you go to.
Well, whatever they've put out, yes.
Right. Okay. The advertisement that was most striking for me in the calendar was Texas Alexander's Blue Devil Blues.
We'll be back after these messages.
Psst. Hey, everyone. It's Nate. Rather than run another ad for one of our wonderful sponsors, I thought I'd take a moment to ask each and every one of you to please consider becoming a member of our Patreon community. Patreon.com/vinylguide is where people like you who are enjoying the show can help support the Vinyl Guide podcast and get extra stuff. At patreon.com/vinylguide, we sometimes throw up secret episodes, stuff that's not available to the public. You get everything early, so that means the jump on any limited vinyl pressings that are going on sale. Plus, it's totally commercial-free. There is not a single ad up at patreon.com/vinylguide. No interruptions, just the interviews and conversations. Now, each week I put up some extra stuff. Often it's an extended episode, more questions, more conversations with the artist. I always put the episodes on Patreon in high-resolution format so you can enjoy a better quality audio experience. And sometimes I'll even do wacky stuff like record giveaways, concert ticket giveaways. Please consider supporting the Vinyl Guide podcast at patreon.com/vinylguide. All righty, thanks for your time, and now back to the show.
No limits.
The advertisement that was most striking for me in the calendar was Texas Alexander's Blue Devil Blues. Can you tell me a little bit about
that? Halloween offering. And we try for the past 20 years, for the month of October, we always try to have something related to Halloween, although this year, the October 2022 image is Old Dog Blue, which has nothing to do with Halloween. But anyway, most of the time we try to do a Halloween one, and this is all about the devil and some women underground and all kinds of crazy stuff, and it's got a great image for the ad, so we used it. Yeah. And it was original color, too. It was not something that was colored later. That when you see it on the calendar, that's the original color of the ad. They did do some of these ads in color. Most people think they were only black and white, but they would do them in color as well, just not as frequently.
Okay, so it's kind of a grayish, as I see it in the calendar. Is that right?
Yeah, it's kind of a gray-blue, and that's the way the original looks.
And this record, is it a rare one? What's the story of the song?
Not necessarily. It's just good.
Yeah.
And it fit with the Halloween theme, so we used it. All his records are fairly common. I mean, they're not like you see them every day, but they're not super rare either. He sold well.
Okay. And what I suspect is probably one of the rarest records you have on this calendar is for December. Brother Fullbosom's A Sermon on a Silver Dollar. Am I saying that right?
Yes. Did you listen to that?
I have not yet, no.
Okay. Well, you need to listen to it because at first glance, you might think it's a religious record. And it was meant for you to think it was a religious record. But think about it for a minute. What preacher would use the name Brother Fullbosom? That just doesn't... that doesn't compute. That's a fake name. And the very first line of his little sermon is, and now I'm going to read to you from the Gospel of St. Louis. And so you get the idea that this is a little bit of a satire and not really an actual religious sermon. And it's really cute. It's really interestingly done. And it's like a satire of every preacher record you've ever heard.
And this was originally released on Paramount.
And yes, and it is apparently the only copy of that to exist, which I didn't know when I bought it, but I hadn't seen it before, and I've never found anybody since that claims to have it, so I think I've got the only one, which was the other reason why I wanted to get it out there before the calendar series ended.
Was this towards the end of the Paramount
run? Yes. It's in the last 100 or so releases, yes.
Okay. And how long have you had this one on your shelf?
For a while, just waiting for the right time to spring it on people. when you hear it, you'll know why I say that.
Okay. Now, when putting these calendars together, I imagine, you know, things pop up right after you've kind of locked down what the calendar is supposed to be. Did anything...
Yeah.
Anything pop up right after you've finished up 2023?
No, not yet. So
okay.
We're safe. We're safe so far. And should it pop up, I'll have to find a way to get it out there if we can. But it's going to be a little time off first.
All right. So we've gone through the calendar, but I know you always have some surprises on the CDs. What else is part of the package, John?
Well, the whole you got up to track 12. Which sort of corresponds with the 12 months of the year. Some of the most interesting stuff comes after that because it's a 25-track CD. And so we have four tracks by Playboy Fuller, also known as Louisiana Red in the 60s, but his original name was Playboy Fuller. We have four tracks from him, from a JVB master tape that surfaced. There's a Scrapper Blackwell that's super great. And then we have some test pressings. We were speaking of test pressings earlier. Mm-hmm. We have Irene Scruggs with Little Brother Montgomery called St. Louis Woman Blues, which was recorded for Paramount but never issued by Paramount. And we found a two-sided take, two-sided with two different takes of that. The interesting thing about that is it's Little Brother Montgomery's very first recording session, and it had never been found before, and people who are into piano blues, they rank Little Brother Montgomery way up there as far as being a great piano blues player, and here's two takes of his very first appearance on record, which had never been released before. And then we got two songs by Edith North Johnson from a missing Paramount, one of the legendary missing Paramounts that had never turned up. That turned up a year or so ago, just after the last calendar. And we've got two tracks there. And then another real interesting one is Memphis Willie Borum, Ain't Gonna Worry My Life No More. Now, that song has been covered by a number of people throughout the years, but nobody was really sure who wrote it. But apparently it was written by Memphis Willie Borum, and it was released on a Japanese 78, never released here in America. And when it was released on the Japanese 78, it wasn't even credited to Little Willie Borum or Memphis Willie Borum. It was credited to Buddy Moss, and with a totally different title. But a copy surfaced over in Japan. A friend of mine got a hold of it, played it, and said, wait a minute, this is not Buddy Moss. This is the long-lost original version of Ain't Gonna Worry My Life No More by Memphis Willie Borum. And it is. It's the earliest known recording of that song. It's him, and it has never been heard until now.
Wow. Okay, so this year, knowing that this is the last calendar, you're throwing all the stuff into the CD.
I'm throwing everything at the wall, yeah. hoping not to break those fragile 78s.
Now, you mentioned 78s being produced in Japan. Like, the international market around this time, what was that like?
Well, I can't imagine it would be very good at all.
Yeah.
I mean, how many, even if you think of Buddy Moss, who is not a super well-known pre-war blues singer, but he's not like totally obscure. But if you think Buddy Moss was not super well known in the United States, who in the world in Japan would have known who Buddy Moss was, and what kind of market would they have had for putting out what they thought was a Buddy Moss record in Japan in 1935? That just boggles the mind, and yet they did. And not only did they put it out, they got it wrong. When they pulled the master off the shelf to press, instead of pulling Buddy Moss, they pulled Memphis Willie Borum out, and it was one that they hadn't used anywhere else, and nobody was paying attention, and out it went. So, well, interesting. I couldn't imagine they sold very many of them at all.
I guess I could imagine some 78s being made in maybe England or some English-speaking territories, but Japan...
Yeah, there's
just
a few there, too, but not many. Not many. It's mostly jazz. The jazz stuff would make it to 78 in England and all that, but not so much blues. That was not something that was being exported overseas very much.
Right. That's an incredible tale of it just popping up in the other side of the world.
Yeah, so there's, you know, we have this whole section after the 12 months. We got a whole 13 more tracks of all this rare and unissued stuff. And I close it out with my favorite Frank Stokes record called I'm Going Away Blues, which I think is the best thing he ever recorded. And it just deserves to be heard by more people. So I put that on as the last track because it kind of goes along with me going away, too, at least for a while.
You're not going away. You're taking a break. All right,
taking a break.
Oh, don't make us sadder than we already are seeing this go. Look, the work you've done over the last 20 years on this has been unsurpassed, and it's generous, it's benevolent, it's wonderful. And you making this music available at great expense and for, I'm going to say, you know, minimal reward for the effort.
Very correct, and thank you very much.
Well, it's been appreciated by everyone. Before we talk about the Marx Brothers, there's been a lot of, you know, transitions in the 78 collecting world. Joe Bizzard's recent passing. Do you have any idea what will happen to his collection? Is it going to go to a museum?
Well,
do you know anything about that?
I can tell you that Joe himself did not want it going into a museum or private archives, and he made that explicitly clear on a number of occasions to anybody that would listen. So I think that the collection is in the hands of his family, and whatever they choose to do with it is up to them. I don't think they're going to donate it anywhere. I think that they're probably going to hang on to it for a little while and then maybe explore how to deal with selling it, either as a complete lot to somebody if they could, or individually. I don't really know. I don't have any insights on it. That's entirely up to them.
Because he's got some incredibly rare stuff, one-offs as well. And keen to understand kind of what the plans are for that. Do you have any plans for your collection? What will happen to your collection far, far off in the future?
I wish I had some plans, but I don't. And that sounds bad, and it's against a lot of people's way of thinking. It's like you should prepare for these things. But I have not. I'm still collecting. I'm 63 years old. I don't intend on stopping until they nail the coffin shut. So I hope I have another 20 to 30 years worth more to keep going. And at some point in the next 20 to 30 years, I'll have to figure it out. I don't know. I too do not really relish the idea of having mine locked in a vault somewhere, because nobody enjoys it when it's locked in a vault. Nobody enjoys it when it's locked in an archive. So there's got to be a way to deal with this, but I have not yet come up with one either.
I'm sure even after they nail the coffin shut, you're going to be looking around being like, okay, what are there... any old collections down here?
My ghost will be wandering the South and the Midwest looking for records.
Yeah, the moment you get to heaven, you're going to be like, okay, where's that J.D. Short record? Let's hear it.
Well, I don't know if it's up there. It's probably still down here, but we'll see.
All right. Well, John, thank you so much, mate.
Okay. Thank you for having me, and we'll talk again.
You got it. Cheers.
Bye.
I hate to see the Blues Images calendar come to an end, but, you know, it had to at some point, and I'm looking forward to John's next project around the Marx Brothers. And by the way, there's a whole nother section up at patreon.com/vinylguide, a whole nother section of this interview up there that features John talking all about his Marx Brothers collection, his archive, the audio, the material, all that stuff. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. Help support the Vinyl Guide podcast up there. Enjoy extended episodes, high-resolution audio files, commercial-free interviews, and more. Patreon.com/vinylguide. And thanks in advance. And that is it for this episode of the Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Put them on Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter. But what's often most helpful is if you just sit down with your record nerd buddies and just show them how to listen to a podcast on that smartphone of theirs. If they don't have a smartphone, show them how to get it online, thevinylguide.com. They'll love you for it, and so will I. We'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some music, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.